Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathy Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm feeling peppery.
I don't know what that means, but okay. we're going to talk today, if you don't mind, about a situation in France.
I think we're going to talk about it even if I do mind. I know you very well.
Yeah, but you'll like this. I mean, you're the French boy. There is an article recently in the New York Times about a growing problem, something we've been watching for a long time. Mm-hmm. Okay, this may sound a little geeky to start, but it has universal implications. It starts from a very narrow focus, but it has universal implications. In Europe, they don't pasteurize, you don't have to pasteurize all your milk. And certainly there are a number of French cheeses and European cheeses that are made from unpasteurized milk.
And cheeses that we eat here in the United States made from those unpasteurized milk.
Well, for a long time, in most of the United States, unpasteurized milk is illegal to sell. You can buy your own cow or a share of your own cow and milk it and drink the milk if you want. Big corporate agribusiness. Look, pasteurization saved a lot of lives because they were in the 1800s serving some milk from some pretty – they were from cows that weren't being treated well, and the milk itself wasn't being treated well, and it was a vector for disease. But there were – at the same time there was a movement to force pasteurization of milk, there was a certified dairy movement that sought to make sure that we had healthy milk by just making sure that the dairies that they came from were clean and treated milk well. And –
one of the things that's happened in science, and again, we're starting a little bit geeky, but I promise to tie this in to something a little bit more broad-ranging in just a minute. One of the things that we have the ability to do now is we can look at our milk and test it and make sure that it's safe. So we can take our raw milk and actually put it through a battery of tests and say, okay, this batch of milk is totally fine to drink.
Well, and plus, when we had milk for, 5,000 years before pasteurization came along, and it wasn't always a vector for disease. It became a huge vector for disease only with the Industrial Revolution, and basically most of the cows that were giving milk wound up being vectors for disease was poorly treated. They were what they call distillery cows. Cows were being fed slop, and it was just – anyway.
So enough about milk. Enough about raw milk.
Raw cheese is a way to preserve milk. Cheese is a way to make sure that if you can't have the milk fresh, that's where cheese and yogurt came from. In this country, we didn't allow all milk had to be pasteurized. Then even all milk to make milk products had to be pasteurized. Well, they changed the law a few years back where now they say in America, as long as the cheese is 60 days old, it's an old cheese, it can be from unpasteurized milk, but it can't be sold before 60 days. And the idea is that if there are any pathogens in the milk, they'll show up by the time 60 days comes around, or that 60 days in an environment where cheese is higher in acid, cheese acts as a preservative, will kill any pathogens that are there. Well, there are certain French cheeses and European cheeses that are meant to be eaten fresh, and Camembert is one of them. You say, well, you have Camembert in your markets here in America, but it's not fresh Camembert. Mm-hmm. It's Camembert made from pasteurized milk, or it's an old Camembert.
Camembert is meant to be eaten about 5 weeks after it's made.
And in Europe, they have fresh Camembert, which is the most magical cheese in the world.
Spectacular.
It's unlike anything you have here.
You know, as a kid, we would go to Europe, and my father would order Camembert, and I just remember thinking, wow, this cheese is great, and then we'd buy it in supermarkets here, or as a young adult here, I would buy it in supermarkets and be like, this is nothing related at all to the cheese that I had in France when I was a kid with my dad.
Now, to responsibly make Camembert, you need to have raw milk cheese. You need to make it on a smaller scale, because when you transport large quantities of raw milk and hold them, it's not as stable as pasteurized milk. two large companies, citing health concerns, of course, Lactalis and the Isigny-Sainte-Mère is the name of the company. I'm not so good with the French.
You know, I don't have it in front of me, but I'm sure that you just
butchered it.
Crushed that.
Well, they make 90% of the Camembert in Normandy. But they've begun to treat the milk this year used to make those cheeses by two different methods. One is filtering, and the other is gently heating, in other words, pasteurizing. They call it, they invented a new word for it because they didn't want to say pasteurized. It's thermizing. They're thermizing their milk.
I surmise that thermizing is pasteurization.
But here's the deal. They can call it Camembert, but the AOC, the Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, which is the governing body that controls the name, says, listen, to be real Camembert, to be AOC Camembert, it has to be the traditional raw milk Camembert. They want to change that ruling.
And your Camembert will actually, if it's made from raw cow's milk cheese, it will actually say AOC right on the label.
And that will put these small farmers out of business. The AOC Camembert gets a higher price because it really can only be made on a smaller scale. Mm-hmm. Now, raw milk activists say the health issue is just a pretext for boosting production. And the chains want to avoid the chains say they just want to avoid any impressions that stuff is unsafe and that the pasteurized milk is safer. Except, of course, that because there's still a demand for it, both of those companies still have raw milk cheese divisions. They still make the raw cheese. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thermizing is thermizing. The French feel so strongly about it that they have there's a group of retired cheesemakers and local businessmen called the Committee for the Defense of Authentic Camembert.
I think it's great that, you know, these people don't have financial interest in Camembert not being pasteurized. These are people who have interest in seeing the things that they created and the traditions that they upheld throughout their careers and their lives continue to be upheld. And I'm going to tell you, there is no doubt in my mind that I prefer the unpasteurized Camembert to the pasteurized Camembert. That's my personal taste, and somebody else can choose can argue the point that they like the pasteurized, or they can even argue the point that they can't see the difference in the two cheeses. But again, what are you doing? You're taking my choice out of it by taking the labeling law away.
Well, and again, the customer has a choice here, and very often big business tries to say, well, we want to give you the choice, we want to make you safer. I understand, but giving me a but I understand that you're lying, because that's not really giving me a choice. You know what I mean? So raw milk cheese, listen, everything doesn't need to be boiled, okay? And in America, very often we have this obsession with covering things in plastic and boiling things nine different ways. Food is real. Food is living. And I believe that raw milk is good for me. I'm actually starting to get involved in the – I want to start getting involved in the movement to legalize raw milk in my state.
I think you're involved in it because we keep talking about it. We've talked about it probably 5 or 10 times on this show. And, again, especially when you're talking about cheese making, raw milk cheeses, there's a taste difference. They taste differently than cheeses that are not made from raw milk.
And always remember that when big corporations say, well, we want to protect you, we want to make sure all the milk is pasteurized, and we want to make sure all the meat is irradiated, well, why are they doing that? It's because...
Right, what's the motivation?
It's because if you pasteurize and you irradiate, well, then you can truck your food over longer distances. You don't have to be as careful like these small artisanal farmers are careful when making their raw milk cheeses. And it sounds like they're trying to keep things cleaner and safer for you. They're trying to make them safer so they don't have to be as clean. So things aren't always what they seem.
So they can be less careful.
Hey, listen, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. It's 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Labardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Ann Rogers. She's an advocate for preserving the dining and drinking history of New Orleans. She created the New Orleans Culinary and Cultural Preservation Society, the Southern Comfort Cocktail Tour, and Tales of the Cocktail.
Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Ann, we are advocates of drinking and dining as well, so we're definitely on the same page.
There you go. I'm on the right show then.
And I think it's important that we not only look to the history of drinking and dining, but also the present and the future. That's where I know I'm going to come across as a, I'm going to get censored by the FCC for advocating that. Now, Tales of the Cocktail, we've heard tell a lot about. We've had a lot of the folks on the show who participate in Tales of the Cocktail, from David Wonders to Gary Regan to Dale DeGroff. This thing lives in legend. You created it. What is it?
Yes, I did. It is a cocktail and culinary festival that spans 5 days in what we call the birthplace of the cocktail, which is New Orleans. And some of the great folks that you mentioned are some of our presenters. Under that five-day umbrella, there's a lot of different activities that people can just participate in. We have seminars, we have spirited dinners, we have a huge event called Cocktail Hour. So they're really, you know, it's hard to, you know, sum up in a quick elevator pitch, but a cocktail and culinary festival is really the, you know, best way to describe it.
And the, my favorite thing about it is most of those events, even the lectures, you can attend with a cocktail in hand, which is one of my favorite postures.
Exactly. You could, or in most of those cases, we're serving you a cocktail.
That's what I was going to say. I prefer the events where you actually bring me one.
Oh, no, I wasn't going to make it. I was just going to hold it in my hand. Now,
I know. If you want to hear a funny story, we're having a breakfast event, and we were talking about a milk punch with a certain rum from Puerto Rico and a food item. Also created with rum and the rums of Puerto Rico, you know, folks out of town were, concerned about, you know, drinking in the morning. And it's like, okay, you know, not that we promote over drinking. We always promote responsible drinking. But, you know, brandy milk punch in New Orleans is nothing out the ordinary. You know, kind of like if you didn't have it, it would be more out the ordinary.
And frosted flakes with milk punch, of course.
There you go. But we really do. And, you know, in all of our seminars, they're all interactive. We all have tastings. You all participate a lot of times in making the cocktails. So they're, you know, very educational and interactive at the same time. And, you know, we really do, you know, we also serve a 5-ounce pour, so it's a small cocktail. But we really want you to learn about the cocktail and appreciate it.
I'm a big fan of the interactive cocktail program.
There you go.
Now, but let's go back to something that you mentioned. Many people feel that the birthplace of the cocktail, both the cocktail itself and certainly the word cocktail, is New Orleans. What is New Orleans the birthplace of the cocktail?
You know, we think it is. I mean, that's, you know, up for dispute by some people. I mean, there are, you know, a few different stories on how the word, you know, cocktail came about.
You're in New Orleans. You give us your story.
Right. Well, we consider the Sazerac the first cocktail, and we consider that created by Antoine Amédée Peychaud, who was a pharmacist. And actually, New Orleans was the home of the first licensed pharmacist, and he began making his Peychaud's bitters and started putting that with whiskey, really in those early days for, you know, medicinal purposes. And the French Quarter at that time, being predominantly French, the word cocktail came out of a French word that was just mangled into cocktail.
Actually, I recall reading that he used to serve them in these little whiskey and bitters concoctions in egg cups, which the French word would be coquetier, that eventually got shortened into cocktail. Is that how it came about?
Right, exactly. And then today, when you see a, you know, jigger with, you know, the top part larger than the bottom, you know, that's a direct derivative of that egg cup.
You know, it was so healthy back then.
And we have a great pharmacy museum in New Orleans, and actually we are holding two museum exhibits this year in conjunction with Tales of the Cocktail, and that particular one is all about alcohol as medicine.
You know, my
Peychaud's bitters, of course, are still made today and very popular.
My uncle used to tell my aunt all the time that whiskey he had in the morning was indeed medicinal.
and you could remove stains with it, and I heard all those.
Yeah. And also, the in my family, we used to have the whiskey aftershave, so that you, when you smelled like whiskey in the morning, it was, oh, honey, it's the aftershave. You're doing exhibits on cocktails as medicine. As part of this event. That sounds like a pretty interesting subject to delve into.
It really is. We're doing that particular exhibit, like I said, at the New Orleans Pharmacy Museum, and it's really the spirited exploration of alcohol as medicine in the 20th century. And really, it's a fascinating small museum. And then we're also mounting a exhibit at the Louisiana State Museum, which is called the Cabildo, and it is self-guided and all about culinary influences.
Well, I want you to know, Ann, that I have been studying medicine and the cocktail in the 21st century, and I'm working very diligently at that.
You guys sound like fun. I wish I was there alive in person. So.
We are. No. let's talk about, we're going to put the links up on our website for how people can find out about and perhaps even attend Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans. How would they go about it? Where can they, is there talesofthecocktail.com?
Talesofthecocktail.com, exactly. That's where you can book a room, which we have a great discounted rate at the Hotel Monteleone of $95 a night. You can purchase tickets to any of the events. You can view the entire schedule. You can see a photo gallery, all at talesofthecocktail.com.
And New Orleans, you know, post-Katrina, we as a country really want to come together and support New Orleans. You're supporting its history, but we also want to send people down there. Is it a fun place to visit again?
Oh, it definitely is. I mean, it really is, you know, time for people to come back to New Orleans. I mean, the culture and the history and all the things about New Orleans that you love are still here and they're still relevant. And, you know, we tell people, show the love. That's the best thing you can do for New Orleans.
Come back to New Orleans. There's the tagline for you. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Ann Rogers about the upcoming event, Tales of the Cocktail, which you can find out more on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or catherinelombardi.com.
Down in New Orleans where everything's fine, all them cats is drinking that wine, drinking that mess, their delight. When it gets drunk, start singing all night, drinking wine, spur you to drink wine, pop, pop, wine, spur you to drink wine.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. It's Mark and Francis. Our guest is Ann Rogers. She is the founder of the New Orleans Cocktail Festival coming up called Tales of the Cocktail. When people come down for Tales of the Cocktail, is it mostly consumers or people in the industry that attend this event, or is it both?
It's both, and that's one of the things that makes it really unique and really fun, is we call it the cocktail enthusiast, and that person's here that wants to learn more. Then we have a tremendous amount of people from the trade, and then we have the most influential gathering of mixologists in the world. And it's a very, I call it sophisticated but relaxed atmosphere, as all of those people interact and just network and, you know, have a great time over these 5 days. But it's, you know, a little bit of everybody.
Now, how long has the Tale of the Cocktail event been going on?
This is our fifth anniversary, so hard to believe, but this summer is our fifth annual Tales of the Cocktail.
So I think that a lot of people want to know what happened to Tales of the Cocktail after Katrina. Did you guys take a hit as well?
We actually grew post-Katrina. It was very interesting. Our 2005 event was in August. It was about 10 days before Katrina. We had just had a phenomenal event, and of course, you know, Katrina happened, and I personally was in different cities and actually spent 3 months in New York and didn't get back to New Orleans until January 1st of 06, but was still committed to having Tales of the Cocktail, and we had a phenomenal 2006 event. We grew despite Katrina and got over that hump, and now we're back on our fifth anniversary. So we weathered the storm, I guess you would say.
Exactly. I guess I've looked at some of the events coming up in this particular package, and it just seems like a great event that gets bigger and better every year that you do it.
I also think that that's really a testament to, you know, people say that restaurants are becoming more and more a part of our culture, and they are. And especially in New Orleans, almost like no other city except, you know, maybe in San Francisco and New York, you know, Chicago makes a claim to it as well. People in the food and wine and cocktail industry are so dedicated to the history and the fabric of the community that we're really trying to when things get down, we all run to the problem, not away from it. Hey, we need to take a break for the news. We'll be back in a moment or two talking with Ann Rogers about the upcoming event, Tales of the Cocktail. We'll tell you more about how you can get involved and what you might find out when you go down there. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with Ann Rogers. She's an advocate for preserving the dining and drinking history of New Orleans. She created the New Orleans Culinary and Cultural Preservation Society, the Southern Comfort Cocktail Tour, and Tales of the Cocktail. And when we talk about New Orleans, the drinking and dining culture of New Orleans, yeah, it's one of the things that draws the tourists to New Orleans. But it's not just a tourist trap. I mean, New Orleans isn't Disney. The food and wine is, I think, maybe more inextricably linked with the culture of New Orleans than any other city in America. Did I get that right? And why are cocktails and dining so important to New Orleans?
I agree with you 100%, and I was going to add to the conversation we were starting to have earlier that, you know, eating and drinking are very intimate things. And, you know, post-Katrina that you asked about, too, you know, the thing you could not wait to do was, you know, get back, and the places that were open initially were just jam-packed. Because it was all about getting out there and, like, reconnecting over food, which is something that, you know, I mean, really, it is inbred in us. But you're right. New Orleans is very genuine. It's very authentic. It's not Disney. We love the, you know, restaurants that have been open 100 years or places like Antoine's that literally have been open before the Civil War. And, you know, it's the longest, you know, continually operating restaurant by one family. And that's part of what we do at Tales of the Cocktail is we love exposing people to that history. So all of our events are at historic venues. We want you to, you know, meet these characters. We want you to dine here. We want you to have a cocktail. You know, we want you to fall in love with New Orleans just like we do. But you're very right. It's just, it's a part of our culture that, you know, cannot be removed and part of the spirit of New Orleans.
Well, it's why New Orleans, everybody, I think, in the country has been behind New Orleans being rebuilt. The reason is because it is such a part of the historical fabric of the United States.
Well, and it's a completely unique city. I mean, that New Orleans itself adds uniquely to the history of the United States. And, you know, we see New Orleans cuisine. You know, where do you see the cuisine of any other city? You know, people will say, well, it's like a New Orleans restaurant. You know, you don't say, oh, it's like a New York restaurant mm-hmm. that you see in Boston.
Or a Fort
Chicago.
Lauderdale restaurant.
Right.
That's not.
But how has.
You know, there's a lot of things born in New Orleans. And, you know, from, you know, we say, you know, New Orleans gave the rest of the world, you know, a lot of great things, the cocktail being one of them, jazz being another one, you know, a lot of other interesting food items that come from New Orleans. But, you know, we do call it America's most European city, and being a port city, just, you know, all those things kind of melded together. And, you know, that's what gives us our unique culture.
How did, now, you know, since Hurricane Katrina, there are obviously a lot of challenges to New Orleans. But even prior to Hurricane Katrina, it's one of the most touristed cities in the United States. It's one of the visited by so many tourists every year prior to Katrina, and tourism is an incredibly important part of the New Orleans economy. How did New Orleans, and especially prior to Katrina, resist becoming a museum of its former self under the weight of so many tourists coming in? How did it not, you know, look like 42nd Street, which is full of, like, Disney theaters in New York now? Anybody who visits New York, if you walk down 42nd Street and you see the mm-hmm. the fake big corporate things, that's not New York.
Or even become a Las Vegas.
Yeah, so how did New Orleans stay really authentically New Orleans?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons for that. The first one being that there's a statistic that 70% of people born in New Orleans still live here. And it's very true. It's like New Orleans gets in your blood, and you just, you know, get it or you don't. It's, you know, a very different city. And so we have that longevity of families here. We're very, very protective of our history, where there's some other southern cities, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas. You know, there's very few people that are actually from that city that grew up there. So when it comes time to, you know, tear down a building or, you know, put up a new development, nobody really notices. Here, those things are, you know, major conversations and heated battles. I mean, We have a lot of preservation groups. So we're just very particular about preserving our history. You know, we're inbred to, you know, throw a great party and host an event. So we love when visitors come, and we love showing them New Orleans because we're very proud of New Orleans despite all of our challenges, and, you know, want to kind of, you know, help them fall in love with it as well.
Is there an influx, or prior to Katrina, was there an influx of people from the outside moving in?
There is. It's always been an interesting person. I mean, there are people that come here for, you know, events. We had a gentleman named Wayne Curtis who has written a great rum book. I mean, he moved to New Orleans because of Tales of the Cocktail. There are people that come to Jazz Festival. They have a great time, and they say, you know what, I've got to live here.
Is that just because they're drunk and they can't leave?
No, it's not true. There are people that, you know, come to Tulane and then love New Orleans and never leave. So, you know, it has a lot of those, you know, people. Right now it's kind of interesting because we are getting a lot of, you know, interesting creative people that are moving here. And the gentleman I'm talking about, Wayne Curtis, he actually did move to New Orleans post-Katrina. He had come for Tales of the Cocktail 2 years ago, just fell in love with New Orleans, went back to Maine, told his wife that they had to move, and, you know, over the course of the next year or two, they made that happen, and they just permanently moved here.
I don't think my wife's letting me move to New Orleans.
You don't think so?
I think it's happening.
Luckily, she agreed.
What now, with New Orleans, we know that there was tremendous devastation with Katrina. We know that the city hasn't been completely repaired yet, obviously. What is the state of the nightlife in New Orleans? What is the state of the restaurants in New Orleans and their recovery?
They're really all in good shape. I mean, right now, if you came to New Orleans, you know, you can definitely go see the affected areas. And, you know, 2 years later, you'll probably still be a little stunned. But, you know, when you're downtown, when you're in the French Quarter, when you're in the areas that, you know, we're hosting, you know, events, you're not going to, you know, really be aware that Katrina happened. And, you know, luckily, again, the restaurant industry, I think, is, you know, one of the most generous there is. I mean, they never ask for anything and are constantly giving. And post-Katrina, too, I mean, there were some miraculous stories of people that, you know, opened 5 weeks after the storm and, you know, cleaned out their place themselves and wanted to get their employees back to work. And so, really, it's just, you know, these individual small businesses, you know, ours included, you know, just doing it, you know, despite whatever, you know, personal hardships you're having, but, you know, getting it done.
Well, the easiest way to show your appreciation to a restaurant for having done those kinds of things is to go to that restaurant.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you think that, you know, I think that we talk about this industry. We love this industry. And, you know, we operate two restaurants. We consult for other restaurants all the time. And we do this radio show now for years, 5 days a week. And we talk about these issues all the time. And I think that one of the things that's changed since Mark and I were 20 years old is that our society holds restaurateurs, chefs in high regard, and more recently bartenders and bar chefs are being held in higher regard as people realize that, you know, restaurants really are part of the fabric of community. And when they dry up and go away and you're left with nothing but the Bennigans and the Denny's, you know, you've lost a place to come together and meet your neighbors. I think what happened in New Orleans with what the restaurant community and how the restaurant community responded there really amazed people. And I think it's similar to how the restaurant community responded after September 11th in New York. Do you think that within the culture of New Orleans, who've always valued their restaurateurs and barmen, that since Katrina, restaurateurs and barmen and people in our industry are held in even higher regard and maybe valued even a little more?
Yes, I do. And I agree. You're right. It's like, you know, over the years that changed. Chefs are definitely celebrities, you know, especially in New Orleans, and it's always been that way. But I think, you know, there's a newfound respect for those people as well. And here we consider a chef someone that not just, you know, is a great cook, but, you know, or a restaurateur is somebody that then also, you know, knows about wine and knows about service and just, you know, all-encompassing.
You know, but again, I agree with you completely, and I think it's a wonderful thing. And with it comes a great responsibility. I mean, we rarely have negative things to say about people on this show that are in the industry, but when we look at sort of the opposite side of things, there's a show on the air now called Gordon Ramsay's
Hell's Kitchen.
Whereas, you know, this guy who evidently is an accomplished chef, he's got Michelin stars, he's got a great restaurant, but he just screams and yells at people, and he plays into a stereotype of the chef that, you know, one of the reasons I hate it so much.
It hurts me. It hurts me to watch that show.
Is because I think we're doing something that has a great deal of social value, and people sort of demonize liquor, and people have an outdated view of a restaurant job as a dead-end job. And a lot of people are working really hard to change that after September 11th, after Hurricane Katrina, every day when we're trying to keep local farmers on the farm. And, you know, for somebody like Gordon Ramsay to come in and do that, I just hope that people don't look to him as indicative of what's going on in the industry. What you're doing down there in New Orleans is great. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk more about the Tales of the Cocktail, which you can find out how to attend. Get yourself on an airplane. Go and visit Tales of the Cocktail. What are the dates, Ann?
July 18th through 22nd.
Sounds like a great time. You got the time off in the summer. Go take it. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Down in New Orleans where everything's fine, all them cats is drinking that wine, drinking that mess, their delight. When it gets drunk, start singing all night, drinking wine, studio to drink wine, mop, mop, wine, studio to drink wine, mop, mop, wine, studio to drink wine, mop, mop.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with Ann Rogers, the creator and founder of a cocktail seminar, which is open to both the trade and the public. Sounds like a blast. It's called Tales of the Cocktail. It's coming up in July in New Orleans. You should get yourself on a plane and go visit.
For our listeners, a lot of our listeners contact us and they're like, oh, you know, I love this guest or that guest. You know, basically, Tales of the Cocktails is a who's who of who's been on the show, and our cocktail guest list. If you like the shows with Ted Bro or Ted Haig or Audrey Saunders or Ed Hamilton or David Wunderich or Dale DeGroff or Bo Timken, any of those shows that we've done with,
they're all going to be there.
All of those people are going to be at Tales of the Cocktail this July. And
we should host a hospitality room. Former Restaurant Guys guests. What do you think, Ann?
Exactly. Every single person that you mentioned will be here, and most of those people are leading seminars. And, you know, we have a lot of events that are complimentary, and then our seminars are $35 a person. So, I mean, it's very inexpensive. You're going to learn from these great folks. You're going to drink cocktails. Most cases, we're going to give you what we call lanyap, which is some great stuff to take home with you.
What's lanyap?
That is our word that means something extra.
Oh. That's
so,
cool.
You know, that shaker that you use in the session, we're going to give it to you to take home with you.
How nice.
That kind of thing.
You know, there are some valuable, we have a lot of enthusiastic amateur mixologists as well as people who work for us who are professional mixologists, and a lot of our friends are in the business. That's the fancy word for bartender, also bar chef. We can also see bar chef. But there are some interesting things that real cocktail bars do that very few in New Jersey do, that the best cocktail bars in the country do. And one of them is when we do research on old cocktails, we have often found that we can't get some of the ingredients that are listed in old cocktails, much like when you're in historical cookbooks. And we have had to resort to making our own grenadine. We make some of our own bitters. We make our own falernum, and our own tinctures of sorts. This stuff is really important because the grenadine you buy in the store is not the grenadine, the historical grenadine that
they
you
didn't have high fructose corn syrup back in 1912.
Red food coloring. You have a whole seminar on that. That's hosted by Ted Haig, who's also been on the show.
Yes, and actually that is going to be a fantastic seminar, and people are tasting 11 different products. And it's going to be phenomenal. Exactly. You mentioned Falernum, which actually Fee Brothers does make these days. And there's some companies that are doing some really interesting things, too, that are starting to recreate some of those products.
We talk a lot about cocktails on the show, obviously. We talk about the alcohols that go in them frequently, and we talk about using fresh juices and using fresh ingredients and how important they are. But some of these mixers, the bitters and some of the other things that go into the cocktails, they are very, very important to the end result cocktail.
Oh,
and
huge.
And I think really sometimes get overlooked by people outside our industry.
Right, because there aren't substitutes for those things. I mean, they're very, you know, specific ingredients. But that is going to be a great seminar. And, I mean, you know, Ted is so knowledgeable. There's been a lot of interest in that.
He actually, a funny story, we had Ted Haig on the show when his last book came out. His nickname is Dr. Cocktail.
Right.
And I had met him years ago in New York, but when he came on the show, we had a lot of fun. We basically laughed for an hour. And he had just come out with his recent book, his most recent book, which is on forgotten cocktails. And he came out with a book called a drink that called for the Brooklyn, which called for a mère piquant.
Mm-hmm.
A mère piquant is a liquor that's not really made anymore. It's actually made, but it's nothing like
what
it used to be.
It's completely changed the formula.
And
it's like New Coke.
Mark's grandmother was from Brooklyn, and her grandmother, Catherine Lombardi. So in our restaurant, Catherine Lombardi, we wanted to have a Brooklyn cocktail. We wanted to have all the boroughs for which there are cocktails named. In case you're wondering, nothing's been named. There's been no cocktail for Staten Island yet. But
and we are grateful.
And who would know what that would be? We have found, after a lot of research, that the Tarani family, which makes those non-alcoholic syrups,
mm-hmm.
Also missed the old Amer Pecan, and they make one alcoholic product that's only available in California called Tarani Amer Appetizer. And we didn't pull all the levers to make it to be able to get it legally in New Jersey. And then Ted's book came out, and he said, yeah, the only substitute for Amer Pecan is Tarani Amer. And we're like, you're our hero, Ted. You're absolutely our hero, because we got to the same conclusion.
Well, you know, you should – I just want to encourage people again, go to New Orleans, support New Orleans, support this great event that's going on July 18th to July 22nd. You really can go and talk to and meet a lot of the people who have been on our show. I really do encourage that for people.
And now this is a five-day event. Has it gotten bigger every year?
Oh, definitely. Our first year, we started with two events on a Thursday, and then every year we've, you know, added more events, and we also change our content every year. So, like, there won't be a seminar next year on lost ingredients. There'll be other things.
It'll be a lost seminar?
Yes, exactly. So we keep it fresh, but then every year we, you know, added new events. This year we have a bar chef competition. We're hosting our first annual Tales of the Cocktail Spirit Awards. And, you know, we encompass a full weekend. Now, you know, we're not going outside of 5 days. Now we're done. But the great thing is, if you're a visitor, you know, you can come in on a Thursday afternoon. You can come in on a Friday. You can even, you know, go home on Sunday if you want. You know, you can go to one event or you can go to 10. It's your choice, and you just, you know, purchase tickets accordingly.
Well, if you need an excuse to visit New Orleans and you don't, this is a good one. It's coming up in July. You can find out about it on our website, how to get tickets, how to go, how to book a hotel. Go have a good time. Learn about the cocktail. And thanks so much for being on the show with us.
Well, thank you.
It's been
thank you very much. I hope you guys can join us.
Well, you know
I'll
what?
Let Bosch, you need to get off.
If we don't get down this year, we're going to send some of our people, but maybe we'll do a live broadcast next year.
Oh, that would be great. We would love to host you in New Orleans. And your people that are coming, you know, please email me and we'll take good care of them.
Extraordinary. That's called the VIP treatment, everybody.
That's right.
In the back door. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Talking with Ann Rogers about the Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans, I really recommend going. I wonder if I made her angry when I kept calling it New Orleans. I try to say New Orleans, New Orleans, but I. I remember when I first discovered real cocktails, and I had been bartending for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
and then I met Dale DeGroff. And I was a wine guy. I was a wine snob. I thought the only way to achieve, you know, that kind of complexity in a beverage was wine or mm-hmm. spirits.
The only thing to pair with food would be wine
and
beer.
And then Dale was at the Rainbow Room in Manhattan, And we met socially, and then we went to the Rainbow Room, and he just amazed me. And one of the first things he said was, he said, yeah, you know how to, and I thought I was a, because I like the history of cocktails.
I remember it was maybe the maybe 90, 91, somewhere in there.
And I know the history of cocktails, and I, you know that in a Manhattan, because when I was taught to bartend, I was told that a Manhattan was sweet vermouth and rye,
mm-hmm.
right? Or sweet vermouth and bourbon, which is a bourbon Manhattan. That's not right. And I knew from my history that a Manhattan was sweet vermouth and rye and bitters.
Mm-hmm.
And I was all proud of myself because I put the Angostura bitters in there. And, you know, now I know the history of the Manhattan and the Bronx and the martini, and the martini used to have bitters in it. But it's much better with the bitters in it. But Dale said to me, he said, yeah, that bottle of bitters on the back of your bar, how long has it been there? I said,
20 years.
I don't know. As long as I've been here. And
what Francis meant by been here is on the planet, actually alive.
And so, and what he did was he took the bitters behind my bar, the bottle of Angostura bitters, and the unopened backup bottle, which was also 20 years old, because we bought them both at the same time. And he opened the new bottle of bitters and poured, like, shook out a whole bunch into a pony glass. And it was this light, almost, you know, a little translucent brown color. And he shook out the one that had been sitting open on my back bar for a long time. And it was black, murky, and mucky. And I said, bitters go bad? He said, yeah, they do, smart guy.
They're a real thing.
Bitters. So I had been enhancing my cocktails with spoiled bitters. Didn't really hurt it that badly.
Congratulations to you.
But I know more now. So if you have that bottle of bitters that you've been keeping forever,
throw it out, buy a new one.
Yeah. Very cheap, and buy a small one. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.